Today at Radio Verulam, we are once again speaking to local MP Daisy Cooper to get the answers to your questions. And just remember, if you've not been lucky enough to get answers from Daisy this month, she will be back again next month to talk to you. But a lot has happened since we spoke in February, and there's a lot to get through today, a lot of important subjects to talk about. Now, one of the positives, hopefully we can talk about a few positives in this interview today. Since we last had a conversation, it was Mother's Day. Were you able to celebrate Mother's Day and with your own mum at all?
No, afraid not. A second one in a row. Still haven't managed to see my mum, but I managed to get a present to her. And quite frankly, given everything else that's going on in the world, I'm just really pleased that I could chat to her on the phone and that, knowing that she's safe and well.
Oh, that is a positive thing to hear. Were you able to do like a Zoom or anything, you know, a little bit of a distance kind of chat?
Yeah, my mum's not a big fan of Zoom. So we had a couple of phone calls on the day and then we exchanged quite a lot of photos of just things that we were up to. So it was nice.
That is good. Technology is kind of bridging that gap that a lot of people have had. So also this month, and it was supposed to be a positive month for it, it was International Women's Day, a celebration of all the accomplishments of females around the world. It's also a time to highlight the construction of many things in society where women are overlooked. So what did you do for International Women's Day?
Well, the week started off rather well with International Women's Day and then went downhill after that. But on the day itself, there were two or three events that I did. So I started off by doing a little talk via Zoom to a local junior school where I just talked to the boys and girls about what International Women's Day means and how sometimes even as little boys and girls, adults, whether that's parents or teachers or friends, can use different language towards boys and girls and that they needed to be empowered to challenge that even from a very young age. So I talked to them for a few minutes in the morning. Then in my lunch break, I joined a group of people at ACOM, which is one of the big employers in St Albans, mostly women, but there were some men on the call as well. And they were talking about allyship in the workplace and the importance of men supporting women. And so we had a discussion about that. And then in the evening, I was really pleased to host my third International Women's Day event in St Albans. And we normally do it in a pub, but this year, again, we had to do it on Zoom. But it was just really wonderful for me to be able to just sit back and not really do very much of the talking at all and just provide a platform for, in this case, six women who have done extraordinary work in the last year during the pandemic, either running the food bank or doing food deliveries, volunteering at the vaccination centres, or in one case, somebody's actually running one of the vaccination centres. It was a really, other people who have been setting up a new charity to support disadvantaged children. So it was a really, really great event. And I was really pleased to demonstrate the amazing women that we have here in our own community.
At the International Women's Day time, I like to revisit some works that I enjoy, Helen Lewis, Caroline Criado Perez, you know, some great works that talk about feminism in the modern era. Are there any authors or specific projects that you'd like to highlight in regards to this to maybe help educate in 2021?
Oh, there's tons of books out, aren't there? Tons of books out there. And to be honest, I can't think of any off the top of my head, but I'm sure there are lots. but in terms of specific projects, I guess, because I'm an MP, I'm very familiar with the Parliament Project. And that's a project that's been set up to encourage women to come forward and stand for Parliament from all different political parties. There's also the 50-50 campaign, which is part of the Fawcett Society. They've been very active at trying to get women involved as well. You'll know, of course, that there's the Centenary Action Group, which is run by a number of women who have been campaigning not just for more female representation in politics, but also for those people who are maybe carers or who have disabilities, and to make politics more inclusive more generally.
So we do have to turn the topic on to, I think, what you were kind of implying there. International Women's Day was overshadowed by what has been a terrible focus on what is supposed to be a time of positivity around women, but we're reminded of unfairness and inequality that prevails, not just in British society, but around the world. But in our British society, we were reminded by the tragic death of Sarah Everard. I want to have a bit of a discussion around this because it is so important. So just starting off, how upset were you over this incident? Did it really shock you?
You know what? I was a real bundle of different emotions that week. I mean, obviously, first of all, you know, all of us, our hearts go out to the friends and family of Sarah Everard, because that's they're at the centre of everything that has happened since. And they're the ones who knew her and loved her and who were grieving for her. But I think her disappearance initially, and then the confirmation that she was dead, really struck a chord with a number of women, because of the fact that she was just walking home. And that phrase, just walking home, has really struck a chord with a number of women, because so many of us could see ourselves in her situation. And I think for decades and decades, women have felt as though their safety has not ever really been prioritised, has never really been talked about. And as a result, I mean, I certainly felt a bit listless. I felt angry. I felt very upset at times, and it all felt incredibly raw. And you know, it's transpired now. We know that I think 97% of young women have been sort of sexually assaulted, and 80% of all women report the same. So you know, it's not all men, but it is all women. And I think that the huge outpouring of grief and rage is testament to the fact that women identified with her situation of just trying to walk home and not being safe in a what was a very short walk for her. And I hope it's going to become a watershed moment to talk properly about women's safety.
And just on that discussion point there, as you pointed out, the data shows that it's every woman seems to experience this. Have you had any of these experiences that women have come forward about subsequently to kind of talk about how it's everyday things that are not normalised for women that men kind of take for granted? What has your life been affected by these kind of actions?
Well, I mean, I think every woman has got an example. So the most common ones that women were sharing online were things like, you know, carrying their keys in their hand. You know, I think I saw an expression where some woman said she had Wolverined her hand, you know, that she had the keys sticking out of her fingers as she was walking home. It's almost commonplace for women to do that. It's not unusual to get your keys in your bag before getting off the train or leaving work or whatever it is, and to carry them in your hand, ready to run to your door or to use it as a weapon if you need to. It's not unusual for women to have to tell people where they are and where they're leaving and say what time they're going to be home. Women self-censor themselves. So, you know, they'll take themselves off the streets at a certain time if they don't feel safe going out. They'll just decide to stay in and not go to the shops to get the milk that they need, or, you know, washing up liquid or whatever it might be. And those are the kind of the smaller everyday precautions that women take. But also there's been a huge outpouring of people's experience of things that are far more severe. So whether that is being sexually assaulted just during the day, in daylight, on public transport, in public spaces, you know, it happens a lot and it happens regularly. I mean, I've had my fair share. I don't need to go into it, but I've had my fair share. And I know how scary it is to have to run away from somebody or to have somebody making pretty aggressive threats at you on public transport. It's not nice. A lot of women don't have any, have the confidence to either challenge it or to report it. And often they feel neglected if there are other people around them who have seen what's happened, and they don't feel empowered to intervene either. So it is a huge widespread problem. And I think we need to see some widespread change.
On this, you've described there, sometimes it is very hard for women to get help. Well, sometimes it's not taken seriously, and I think that is one of the most shocking things. So you discussed on Radio 4 that everything needs to change. What is the starting point?
So I think the starting point is that men need to call out other men when things are said or done that are not okay. So all these things are, so you know, you get microaggressions that are on the same scale, you know, on a sliding scale up to very sort of serious assault. But if you hear men or women, but it is predominantly men, making remarks about a woman, you know, what he wants to do to her or what he wouldn't do to her or something like that, you should call it out and let people know that it's not acceptable. Now, if you're walking down the street and it's dark and you want to overtake somebody, if you want to overtake a woman, whether that's, you know, on foot or on a bike or something, then, you know, you can step further away, you can cross over the road, create more space so the woman feels less threatened, so that there is more space there when she's walking home. She knows that you're not a threat. If you see a woman in a situation where she doesn't look comfortable, you know, feel free to be an active bystander and to ask if she's okay or if she needs any help. You know, it's okay to do these things and it's a good thing to do. So there's the everyday stuff like that that's important. And if in any doubt, talk to the women that you know and ask them what's okay. I think in many cases it is for men to educate themselves on how they can help women feel safer. Because it's not every single man, but as a woman, you don't know which man it's going to be. So therefore, we take precautions against all men. and therefore, so men can play an active role in making our public spaces feel safer in terms of calling out that kind of behaviour. But we also need to see changes in the system. And what I would like to see is the government running a huge public awareness campaign around what it means to be an active bystander. I'd like to see proper resourcing of our policing system and our justice system. We know that, I think it's... less than one in five or one in eight, I think it is, less than one in five or one in eight rape cases are actually reported. So we need to see far more investment in those kind of services. And then for women who do experience domestic violence or domestic abuse, they need to be able to have safe places to go to. Now, we're lucky that in Hertfordshire, there is funding for domestic abuse hotline and also for various refuges. But women need to know that these places have got secure funding and they'll continue to exist. Nationally, there have been major cuts to women's services. And we need to see some of that restored.
Yeah, this is what I was going to ask actually, is in St Albans, you've mentioned a few of those kind of places that they can seek refuge. I mean, what kind of advice can you give to people in the St Albans area if they're feeling in trouble?
Well, I guess it depends what situation they're in. But of course, if there is an immediate threat, they can call the police. So that's, you know, you call 999 an emergency or 101 if it's not quite an emergency. So that's the initial call that you would make. If something has happened to you, if you have been sort of sexually assaulted, you can go to your GP. You can contact victim support. If you there's also the rape crisis line. There's also an NHS sexual assault referral centre. And if you're, of course, if you're a victim of domestic abuse or domestic violence and you want to escape, you can contact the Hertfordshire Domestic Abuse Helpline as well. So there are people out there willing to help, lots of different places that women can go depending on what's happened and how urgent it is.
And in some of these situations where women find themselves in trouble, they can't actually express that they are in direct danger. Are there special trigger words that maybe a police officer or a pharmacist would understand, or a doctor, to kind of explain that they're in danger without saying it, or maybe some hand symbols as well?
Yeah, so there's quite a lot of these new schemes which are sort of popping up all over the place, which are there to empower women to indicate if they are... if they are at risk. So I think the one that you use in a pharmacy is, I think it's Ask Annie, A-N-I, that's it. So if you go into a pharmacy and say, oh, I'd like to speak to Annie, that is a sort of code word that indicates to the pharmacist that you need to go into a private area to have a conversation with them. And that's really helpful. I wasn't aware of this until the last couple of days, but I have seen something appearing on Facebook, which is a hand signal that you can use to actually indicate to other people that you're at risk. And I know we're on the radio, so it's not the best way of demonstrating it, but as far as I can tell, it's like holding up your hand so the face of your palm is facing the other person, and then it's folding your thumb in and then folding your fingers down over your thumb. And apparently this is a symbol and a way of indicating that you need some help. So if, for example, you know, someone was to deliver a package to your door and you were at the door with somebody in the house with whom you don't feel safe, you could provide that hand signal perhaps behind the person who you see as a threat to you. And that would indicate to the person outside that you need some help. I wasn't aware of that myself until the last couple of days. So I don't know how widespread that is or whether people would recognise the symbol, but it might hopefully be one of those things that catches on.
Yeah, I think you're describing the international symbol for help me, which I think is hugely important for this situation. I think when we put this up, we'll put up some of these bits of information as well, because it is so important. And the Ask Annie scheme is a brilliant idea. And just coming back to what men can do, and I think one of the shocking things for me doing research for this discussion for you was in 2019, the majority of men, and this was written in the Independent, believe that women are more likely to be sexually assaulted by wearing revealing clothes. I think this is the type of thing that you're describing there, Daisy, that men need to challenge other men on this sorts of stuff. So do you have a good kind of source of information to challenge these incorrect myths or bits of data that a lot of guys buy into?
Sure. I mean, I think the first thing to say is to actually reiterate that message. A lot of the language that we use around male violence towards women, a lot of the language we use is very passive. So we might say that a woman has been assaulted, or a woman has been raped, or a woman has been murdered. We never say a man has raped a woman, or a man has assaulted a woman. And I think, you know, the language we use is so passive, it sort of suggests that it is the fault of the person rather, you know, who's on the receiving end, rather than the person who's the perpetrator. And as a result, that gives rise to victim blaming. And we've seen this not just in terms of casual conversation, but we've seen it cited in courtrooms as well by judges in the past. Now, you know, a lot of training has been done to try and change that. But the fact is that women do not get assaulted and raped because they're wearing low-cut tops or short skirts, or because they've had a drink. You know, they're being assaulted and raped because men are assaulting and raping them. And we need to make sure that we are very proactive about that language and be clear about where the blame lies, and to stop that kind of victim blaming. To be honest, I hope that there is somewhere a sort of a website or a resource or a book somewhere that has that information for men. I'm not aware of one myself, and that probably is part of the problem. What I would say is I know that, you know, the vast majority of this kind of sexual violence is perpetrated by men towards women. There can be male victims as well, and there is a dedicated organisation called Survivors UK, which does provide advice to male victims of abuse, and it's important that they have that source of information as well in case anybody is listening who needs it. But I do think, as I say, that we need to have... we need to have a sort of public awareness campaign around, you know, what consent means and what it means to be an active bystander, and where men can educate themselves about what it means to help other women, help women feel safe in public spaces.
So to end this discussion here, although I hope the discussion does go on outside of just you and I, Daisy, but do you believe that the government has had the right response so far? Do you believe that they're taking the right action? Because one of the ideas that has been flagged is ununiformed policemen in bars, and a lot of women were decrying that because they felt that that's not the help that they need. It's like you said there, on the education side, on language and things to do with understanding women's victimhood here. So can you describe what your feelings are towards the response so far?
I thought that was a really, insulting response, because it only dealt with one tiny angle, which is policing. There are lots of different things that need to happen, let's be honest. The government hasn't said anything yet about what needs to happen in terms of education, you know, around consent, around being an active bystander, around public awareness campaigns. The government said nothing at all on any of that. I felt as though their response to the protests last Saturday were a really poor response. There had been a High Court challenge, and the High Court had indicated that the door was open to police forces to engage with organisers. And around the country, police forces did precisely that. And I commend all of the police officers around the country who did engage with the organisers and allowed peaceful, socially distant vigils to go ahead. And I've heard reports from friends and campaigners as well, that at some of these vigils, you know, the police stood back at a distance. They just gently reminded people to keep socially distance, and people were allowed that opportunity to grieve and mourn. But that didn't happen in London, and I think that a lot of the blame lies with the London Metropolitan Police. But there has to be some blame on the government as well. I think two things have happened this week in Parliament after a lot of opposition. Lobbying, the government has now finally agreed to make misogyny a hate crime. And this is not just a thing about language. It's really important, because once something is a hate crime, it means that it attracts more, it tends to attract higher reporting rates in terms of people reporting the crimes. Those crimes also get taken more seriously, and there's more resourcing to tackle them. So that's a really good move. So I'm glad the government's done that, and I support them in doing that. On the flip side, the government has brought forward a policing bill this week, which has very long sentences for people who might, for example, want to attack a statue, but doesn't have very strong sentences for people who might want to attack a woman. And therefore, I think the government needs to think again about this particular bill that it's bringing forward in Parliament to make sure that it does include proper penalties for people who do and people who do attack women.
And just to repeat your sentiments earlier, Daisy, our thoughts go with Sarah Everard's family and, of course, absolutely, all the women who are suffering at the moment due to unfair and injustice within the system. So let's move the discussion on to, though, a way that is engaging with Parliament itself and hopefully changing things there. You appeared in the remotely representative House discussion this month to highlight unfairness in the House of Commons and what needs to change when sessions resume to normality. Do you know if the great work from Dr. Jessica Smith is being examined or taken up by Parliament?
Ah, well, we'll have to wait and see, because I honestly don't know where it's going to go, but I thought it was a good piece of work. So, I mean, this was a piece of work done to look at the impact of having a virtual parliament. And there were a number of MPs, including me, that talked about how this hybrid parliament, which is part physical and part virtual, has improved inclusivity, basically. And there's a number of MPs that can't go into parliament, either because they're shielding or because they have caring responsibilities. Or they're clinically extremely vulnerable. And so there are lots of reasons why MPs haven't been able to go into Parliament. But the virtual Parliament, where you can, some people can go in and some people can do it online, I think is something that should be retained as an option. So, you know, there are lots of MPs who, you know, when it's safe to go back and when restrictions start to ease, you know, there are some things that you simply can't replace. And all MPs enjoy the sort of the cut and thrust of the argument and the debate that you get in the chamber. And you simply can't get that level of debate, you know, via Zoom. I do think that there are some, you know, there are lots of sort of Q&A sessions where you have to ask a very quick question and a minister has to respond. There are some parts of what Parliament does that could be done online and would certainly help a lot of MPs who maybe have long-term conditions, who maybe have long COVID, who maybe have caring responsibilities. So the event that you're referring to was really about how we can use this digital innovation to make Parliament more inclusive for more people. And in doing that, it might improve the diversity of people that then go into politics, and that could only be a good thing.
So another sobering thought just before we get into the community questions is the fact that as we talk now, it's about a year since the country went into lockdown. And obviously the full scale of COVID-19's impact was only just being realised. What are your reflections on a year of dealing with COVID in St Albans?
Goodness me. I think people are feeling very strange at the moment. I think everyone's exhausted. I think everyone's exhausted and very tired of sort of the restrictions. But I think there's also a sort of creeping uncertainty and anxiety that a number of people are feeling about what it's going to be like when restrictions are eased and what they feel comfortable. Are they going to feel comfortable going into certain places? And are they a bit shy about it because we've had these kind of boom and bust of lockdowns before? So I think there's a combination of exhaustion on the one hand, anxiety about what's to come. I think the announcement about the delay of the vaccine for a month now also means that people feel like they're a little bit in no man's land. So people are sort of anxious and uncertain about that. But I also get the sense that there is a sort of a bubbling up of anger about how the pandemic was managed. And I think in the last two or three days, we've seen, particularly nationally, but also locally, people clamouring to say why an inquiry needs to happen. I think the families of the bereaved are saying, you know, lessons could have been learned last autumn and they weren't. I think we're not out of the woods yet. And I'm very worried about what the future holds for a lot of people. There was some interesting data on TV last night suggesting that a lot of households have managed to save a lot more money during the pandemic because they haven't been eating out so much or they haven't been commuting. But actually, loads of households have actually had to go into huge amounts of debt. And so I worry that coming out of the pandemic, People are going to be affected in very different ways. Inequality is going to grow. The disadvantage gap is going to grow. We're going to have some people who will be in a better position, others who will be in a lot worse position. And I think there are really big questions to ask about why it is that we ended up with this, you know, boom and bust of various lockdowns, why it was that the second wave doubled the number of deaths that we had from the first wave, when actually the second wave was supposed to be smaller, why it is that billions and billions have been thrown at this test and trace system that was supposed to stop the second and third lockdowns, and why so much money can be spent on that and, you know, not on other things like nurses' pay. I think there's a lot of questions to ask, a lot of questions to answer, and I think the only way forward now is to have that inquiry.
We've talked, obviously, through the majority of it, and I think one of the big moments was when we discussed what you did with Watford Hospital, getting the oxygen back there, and you discussed how emotionally draining it was. Do you feel that you're happy with what you've done during this time, but also do you feel very emotionally drained, just constantly having to chop and change your tactics?
Well, I'd like to think that I'm pretty conscientious, so I'm pleased that I have been able to raise a number of issues, and I've managed to help, you know, quite a lot of people in different ways, you know, whether that's helping people, helping repatriate individuals back to the country, or whether that's, you know, sorting out, enabling them to say goodbye to a loved one on a laptop, on an iPad, or, you know, whether it's helping connect people to the food bank and whatever, you know, helping businesses get their business loans. There's a lot that I have done. I think, obviously, I wish I could do more. I always wish I could do more. It's something that I think people who push themselves hard always want to be able to say. So, yeah, there are things of which I'm proud, but I have to say there's still a lot more work to be done, isn't there? You know, and I'm head down. I'm going to keep going until as a community, we're back on our feet. It's going to be a very long and hard period of recovery, I think. In many places, St Albans, or in many ways, St Albans is probably better placed than some other parts of the country. You know, we have, just before the lockdown, lots of people were coming to St Albans in terms of boosting, before the pandemic hit, we saw that tourism rates were improving. So we know that people want to come to St Albans. We know that's going to help our businesses. You know, we know that our COVID rates are sort of generally on the whole coming down, although it's been sometimes goes up a little bit, but generally it's on the coming down. So, you know, we are in a good position to have a good recovery, but it's going to be it's going to take a long time. It's going to take a lot of hard work. And I think there's going to be a lot of people who have been hit really hard by the pandemic, particularly in terms of either because they're bereaved, they've lost somebody, or because of their mental ill health. And we have, you know, as I think I may have said to you before, I'm very concerned that we may see a tsunami of mental ill health as we come out of the lockdown, because we know that a lot of people aren't going to see their GPs to talk about it at the moment, but at some point they're going to, and there's going to be a lot of referrals. So I'm already busy talking to the mental health teams in Hertfordshire to keep a track on the numbers, to see as and when I can help and intervene and make sure we've got the resources we need to make sure that everyone's supported.
Well, let's hope that preemptive action can help a lot in the communities you mentioned there. But as always, we put out four people to send in questions to you, because Radio Verulam is here to help the community. And so let's move into what the area want to know. So first of all, I don't normally pay too much attention to negative comments on social media, Daisy. I think that it's not helpful. It's not good for, as you mentioned there, mental health to look at negative responders. But somebody did put in a few comments on one of the feeds about one of your podcasts, and so I thought it was only fair for you to respond to them. Mark expressed his opinion that he preferred Bim Afolami as an MP because at least he attends the House of Commons. The St Albans MP seems happier to work from home, and had said, you know, some other negative comments. So could you explain to individuals like Mark why you've taken this choice to work from home?
No, I'm very happy to. I mean, the first thing to say is it's the government's own coronavirus guidance that people should work from home if they can. So in the purest sense, I'm following government guidance, which is to work from home if I can. That's the first thing to say. The second thing to say is that most of what Parliament does is online as well, so I can take part in the virtual Parliament. And having seen that comment, I can tell you that I have actually taken part in Parliament a lot more than Bim has. So I've taken part 76 times since getting elected, and apparently he's taken part 58 times in terms of speaking in the chamber. So hopefully that would hopefully that can explain to Mark that even though I'm taking part remotely, I am still taking part in parliamentary proceedings. And the third thing to say is, as I mentioned before, I have an underlying health condition. I don't think I should put myself at risk by going into Parliament. But also, if I did catch COVID and come back to St Albans, there is a risk that I that could then potentially be a super spreader in my own community. And I don't want to put other people's health at risk. So what I'm doing is I'm protecting my own health. I'm protecting the health of my community by following the government guidance, by working from home because I can. And it isn't in any way inhibiting my ability to contribute to parliamentary work, to speak in debates. I don't know whether Mark follows me on Facebook or not, but I can say that I took part in Prime Minister's questions last week. I'm actually having a meeting with the vaccines minister this afternoon via Zoom. So I've had lots of ministerial surgeries. I've been challenging the Prime Minister directly. I can do all of that from home in line with the government guidance.
And just on that discussion point of underlying health conditions, many MPs do have these, whether it be asthma to something much more serious. And I think comments like that from people like Mark don't understand the reality that MPs are humans. I think that is one of the most unfair things about it.
That's right. And actually, I think it's an important point to say that we are trying to lead by example, because across the country, there are lots of different workplaces where people are either shielding, or they have an underlying health condition, or they have caring responsibilities, and their employers are not as understanding. And I think it's really important that Parliament leads by example by saying that where you have employees who are shielding or are at risk because they have an underlying health condition or they have caring responsibilities, then those employers across the country should be flexible and should accommodate those employees. And I think it's a really important message to send out. This culture of presenteeism, where you have to sort of physically turn up somewhere to take part, that culture is gone. You know, that culture is gone. It should have gone a long time ago. It's out of date and it excludes people. We need to be working as a country towards having a more inclusive workplace culture. And I think Parliament should be leading by example in showing that that can be done.
So Dean has moved the conversation onto something very local. And just to remind people, you can email in at any time to jason.mckenna@radioverulam.com to just send in questions. The inbox is always open, so it's always there. He's asked about the old butterfly world site. He said usage has become a considerable concern for Chiswell Green residents. The site has fallen into disrepair and has, since 2019, been used without permission by a local recovery company. Planning permission was recently refused, and yet 300 plus vehicles remain on site with daily traffic to increase this number. He's asked what is being done by planning enforcement to stop this following the recent refusal of permission to operate on this site.
It's a good question, and I've been really alarmed to see all these reports. I've seen it on Facebook, and a number of constituents have been emailing me as well. I know that a couple of our Lib Dem councillors and some of our activists have been talking to local residents down there in a socially distanced fashion, and they've raised it with the district council. I've also raised it with the district council, and I'm chasing for an answer on it. So the honest answer is I don't know yet, because I'm waiting for an answer, but I am on the case, as are our local councillors, and we just need to ask the officers what's happening in terms of enforcement, but we'll get back to people as soon as we can.
This might be something to bring up in next month's discussion to see if there is progress. But one thing that feels like needs progress right now, Talia has sent in a message about the government's amendment to a bill that protects the employment rights of pregnant people. Talia kind of explained that previously this bill was gender neutral, but when it reached the House of Lords, the gender neutral nature of this was removed for only pregnant cis women, cisgender for people listening. Daisy, will you step in and intervene on what is a discriminatory act of legislation, as Tali has described it?
Sure. I mean, this was a really disappointing debate that happened in Parliament. So in reality, all legislation, whatever topic it's about, any topic at all, whether it's about transport or whether it's on pensions or whether it's on equality, whatever the legislation is on, it refers to person. It's part of the legislative language that is used when writing new laws. And it just so happens that in the case of this particular bill, people objected to the use of the word person, even though that is the standard language that is used in all legislation. Some people made the accusation that by using the word person in relation to people who were pregnant, that was somehow trying to erase the word woman out of any kind of lexicon. Now, I'm very happy to identify as a woman. I use the word woman all the time. I've been talking on your show about men who assault and rape women. I've been using that word. I have no problem with that word. And I'm not trying to erase it from any kind of dictionary or from public discourse. But this should have just been a piece of legislation that used the word person because that's the official legislation that was used. But it became a hot point of discussion as to whether or not it was including or excluding trans people who might be pregnant. And I was really disappointed that that conversation even happened in this context. So it was used as a hook for people to make a particular point. I personally think that the word person should be used on the basis that this is the kind of language that is used in all legislation, and therefore legally it's the right phrase to be using. And I do agree with what Talia is saying. You know, trans rights have become a very divisive and very heated topic in this country, in a way that other issues like immigration have, you know, in the not too distant past. And I think it's really disappointing that some people are trying to pitch women's rights against trans rights. It is entirely possible to protect the rights of all. There are some difficult conversations to be had about, you know, particular circumstances and how things can work, and which, you know, and you know, if rights do come up against each other, how you resolve those. And there's, you know, there are debates around that to be had, but fundamentally I am in support of trans rights are human rights, but that should never have been the discussion that was even taking place in the context of this piece of legislation. The word person was being used because that's the term that is used in all legislation, and I was really disappointed that people tried to hijack it.
So the fact that person is the usual language used in legislation, do you think that it is a fair accusation that this was outright discriminatory because the language was deliberately moved to be exclusive of trans persons?
I mean, that would have to be probably challenged just to say either way. I mean, the fact is the word person should have been used because that's the right language that is used in legislation. I think it's disappointing that the government felt pressured into changing the word to the point where it would exclude trans women. I don't know whether I genuinely don't know whether the use of the word woman would exclude or include trans women. I just don't know, basically. So there's a debate to be had around this, but as I say, I think it's really disappointing that the debate was hijacked to make this about trans rights rather than about the right word that should be used in legislation.
Michael has turned the topic onto something he feels it seems very strongly about in his strongly worded message to you. I just want to ask, is he kind of overreacting to the situation? Because he's said limits on freedom of speech, protests are now warmongering with increasing weapons of mass destruction. Is this the government that is the most undemocratic and illiberal in the UK since World War II? Why are the general news media sitting on this rampant authoritarianism?
Well, that's certainly a view. I mean, the fact is I'm deeply concerned about a huge number of things the government is doing, for sure. And when you give powers to a government, they very rarely give them back. And this is one of the dangers we have, because at the start of the pandemic, it was such an extraordinary and unprecedented situation. And Parliament did hand over enormous powers to the government and we sort of gave up quite a lot of our parliamentary scrutiny because of the circumstances that we found ourselves in. As a Liberal Democrat, I voted against the renewal of that emergency legislation in September last year because, as a party, we felt as though it was important that the government worked cross-party to bring forward legislation that we could all agree to and that ended the use of particular measures. And of course, you know, we lost that vote, and that was the point at which the government included all these new measures about restricting protests under the emergency legislation that we've seen played out in the last week or so. So I'm very concerned about its attempts to limit protest. The way that the current legislation is drafted is very dangerous, I think. It says that anybody who makes too much noise or disturbs somebody could be fined and also potentially imprisoned. And that is, of course, the complete purpose of going on a protest. The reason why you go on a protest is to make noise and disturb people, because all other political and democratic channels have failed you, and you have no other way left of raising your voice other than to bang your drum and walk down the road and shout and scream and get your banner out. And that's the whole point of protest. So I'm very worried about what the government is doing on that. And certainly I will continue to oppose the government's moves to bring those restrictions in Parliament.
Sarah has kind of continued that discussion, because she's asked, why does the government have money for nukes but not nurses?
Well, it's a question of priorities, isn't it? And I think the government has got money for nukes. It's also got billions of pounds for a test trace system, that's the Serco test and trace system, which, you know, still isn't working properly. And I think for a fraction of that amount of money, we could have had one run by our local public health directors. But as Sarah suggests, I think the NHS, and certainly people I've spoken to in the NHS, feel like the announcement of a 1% pay rise, which in reality is a pay cut, because inflation and the cost of living, cost of food, everything is going up higher than the money that they might actually get. It's a real slap in the face. It's a real slap in the face to NHS workers who are completely exhausted. You know, they haven't had a break for the last year. They've had to work through these two enormous waves, and many of them have lost colleagues. They've lost patients. They might have lost loved ones as well. They've been working all hours, doing extra shifts. And I think it's really appalling that the government has offered them such a pitiful so-called pay rise. From my point of view, it should be at least 2.1%, which is what was recommended as a pay rise for NHS workers before the pandemic. Let's see what the pay review suggests, and see whether it suggests something higher. But at least 2.1% is my view.
Moving the discussion to more local things in St Albans, Antonia has sent in a question saying, last month you discussed how well the vaccination scheme had gone in St Albans, but since then there have been problems. Why has St Albans had a supply issue?
Great question, and I've been trying to get to the bottom of it for weeks now. So the first thing to say is there is a national problem with supply. So some people will have seen this on the news even last night. There isn't as much supply as we had hoped, and therefore the vaccination effort nationally is slowing down and will continue to slow down over the next 3 to 4 weeks. That said, there do appear to be some issues with supply in St Albans, there are questions around whether or not our local centres are getting as much vaccine as they should be getting. There's a lot of complicated data that we're looking at to see whether or not that is substantiated or not. There are other concerns about communications and the distribution of vaccine. And as it happens, I'm actually meeting with the vaccines minister this afternoon with some of our local GPs to try and get to the bottom of some of these questions. But I did write a letter to the vaccines minister a few weeks ago. I've been chasing his office every day for the last couple of weeks. As I say, we have got that meeting this afternoon. So I'm sorry I don't have the answers yet, but I'm like a dog with a bone on this one, and I'm trying to get answers as soon as I can.
Michelle is a bit distressed about the Auburn Arena. She's asked, the Auburn Arena has been used for mass vaccination centre in St Albans, but will it be returning to use as a great art centre when COVID is over? And she's also asked, do you enjoy going to shows there?
Well, I really hope the Auburn Arena does go back to being the great art centre when COVID is over. As far as I'm aware, it's an NHS mass vaccination site that started there. I say it's called a mass vaccination site, but actually it'll be able to do a fraction of, you know, what's been happening at Batchford Hall. I'm sure it's a sort of a fairly short term or maybe rolling contract or something. I'm sure it will go back to being the art centre that we all know and love. And yes, I do enjoy going to some shows there. I haven't been to many, I have to say, but I really enjoyed the Gang show. I went to see that with my husband. And of course, I'm a bit of a regular at the Camera Beer and Cider Festival that always happens at the arena as well.
Moving it on to other foodstuffs, and a lot of people have been affected by floods in St Albans. Keith has asked, what is being done to ensure that the cotton mill allotments don't flood again?
Sure. Well, I went down there in my yellow wellies and had a look around. And the flooding is devastating, you know. And of all the years when flooding was going to take place, this was an awful year because people have had such a tough time during the pandemic. And they've put so much love and effort into their allotments, you know, nurturing plants and vegetables and everything else. And so much of it has gone to waste because the flooding is huge down there. So the fact is, there's two or three different issues. And one is just the change in the climate. You know, we've had three massive rainfalls over the last several months, and they're kind of rainfalls that would ordinarily happen once every 100 years or something. So there is just a bigger issue about the climate, and if it's just going to pour down with rain, then there's an issue there. But there are other issues that are specific to that particular allotment, and one is that there's a riverbank, and I went down and had a look at it. There's clearly some structural problems with the riverbank, and as the water is rising in the River Ver, it comes down a corner in a really kind of sharp, quick fashion, and some of that water is coming through the bank, not over it, but through it. And I could see that there was at least two, possibly three places where the water was coming through. So I've been working closely with our Liberal Democrat councillors, Ashley Rowlands and Sandy Walkington, as well as our district councillors as well. We have asked the Environment Agency and Affinity Water to both go and look at the site. The Environment Agency, hopefully, I need to chase up when they're going to go and do this, but I think they're due to have a visit down at the riverbank to see if they can repair that particular structural problem that's there. There's obviously broader issues about how the Environment Agency and Affinity Water deal with flooding along the Ver, because it's obviously, your question was about Cottonmill, but of course there's been lots of flooding at the Berriedale allotments as well, down in Park Street, which I've been to see as well. So, you know, as I say, structural issues we'll try and sort out as quickly as we can, but then there are some longer term issues about what we do when we have to think about the changing climate.
Mandy has moved the discussion on to maybe introducing people to politics, the little people in our lives. She said you had a lovely video on World Book Day on Amazing Maisie. And Mandy said reading is so important, but getting young people interested in politics is needed as well. What are your tips for getting children passionate about it?
I love this question because I talk to quite a few Beavers and Brownie groups and things in St Albans all the time about this. But basically, I think from a very young age, kids can start to care about people and causes. So it might be that they want to save the elephants, or maybe they want to stop homelessness, or maybe they want to save the bees, or maybe they want to have a better play area in their park. There's all sorts of things that kids care about. And I think the key thing is to work out what your kid cares about. And politics really comes down to people and causes. You know, your kid doesn't have to go to parliament. They don't have to learn how many MPs there are. They don't have to know what a constituency is or a councillor. None of that stuff really matters. It's about people and causes. And I'd work out what people care about, and then ask them what it is that they want to change, and then help them find ways of changing it. So if they want to save the bees, then maybe they can start planting some bee bombs and watch some little wildflowers starting to grow. You know, if they want to stop homelessness, maybe they can, you know, start raising some money by selling cakes in a COVID secure way, whatever it is. But I'd start with whatever it is that they care about, and then help them find a way to make a difference.
So the final question is hopefully a positive one to end on. Nicola is asking about, what are you going to do once things open up on the 26th of April? Things on the roadmap, if the country continues in the positive trend, things will open up. She said, are you excited for this, Daisy? And what will be one of the first things that you do?
Well, obviously we know that the government has said that the roadmap is dependent on data, not on dates. So we'll have to wait and see how things pan out over the next few weeks. But assuming that various places open up on the dates that we expect them to, then as and when the pubs open, I have to say I'll probably be in a pub garden somewhere with a pint as soon as I'm allowed to do so legally.
Well, that's a good answer there for Nicola. And hopefully we've given some good answers to everybody in the community today. But thank you for your time today, Daisy. And as always, we say, for those of you who didn't have your question answered by Daisy, she will be returning next month. But Daisy, thank you so much for your time today.
Pleasure. Thanks so much.